Tonight on Arena, I Am Woman, Summerland and Henry Glassie Fieldwork are the movies up for review. And Nick Hornby talks to us about his new novel, Just Like You. Five on 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we begin tonight with films up for your consideration. Summerland, a tale of wartime evacuation, which brings together an odd couple of sorts. I Am Woman, the story of singer Helen Reddy, voice of Australian feminism, who died just last week. And Pat Collins brings us a new documentary, Henry Glassie, Fieldwork. Justin McGregor and Ruth Barton are our reviewers this evening. Justin with me in studio, Ruth joining us down the line. I will start with I Am Woman, Justin. Just remind us of who Helen Reddy was, first of all. Died only last week at the age of 78.
Yeah, no, she just died last week. And yeah, she came to prominence in the early 70s, just after the 60s had started winding down. Got a big hit with I Don't Know How to Love Him, which was a cover of the song from Jesus Christ Superstar. Then had I Am Woman, Delta Dawn, a huge string of hits. And I think had three albums go number one in 1 year, the first person since the Beatles. So they didn't expect it. They didn't think this was going to happen. But at the same time, she was an outspoken feminist. And that was showing up in her lyrics about empowerment. And of course, I Am Woman became the anthem of the ERA movement, the Equal Rights Amendment movement in the United States at the time.
So it would seem, Ruth Barton, that Helen Reddy is a great subject for a film, given, you know, that mix of international pop star and this feminist, a very strong feminist activist.
Yes, it would seem so, but unfortunately this film is about as exciting as sitting in on Helen Reddy recording her work, which is kind of, sometimes you feel that's just what you're doing. I think one of the keys is Alice Cooper, actually. Alice Cooper dubbed her the Queen of Housewife Rock. And what the film is really torn about is representing her faithfully as a kind of housewife, very, very safe figure, but also celebrating her identity, as you know, Justin says, the person who sings I Am Woman. And so it gives us an awful lot of her background. So, you know, some quite nice renditions of the songs, though not actually sung by Helen Reddy either. But it drifts on through this kind of fairly ordinary story. When I see a rock star biopic, you know, I'm expecting drugs and rock and roll, but the only person really who takes drugs is her husband in the movie, Jeff Wald.
Jeff Wald, is he her second husband, Justin, or is he the first husband? And what's the state of the marriage when we meet them?
Yeah, no, she'd married, rebelliously married a member of her parents' band back in Australia. She'd had a child, Tracy, with him, and then won this contest to go to have her demo heard in the States, and took her daughter with her. And so then she meets Jeff Wald, and in real life they got married after 3 days, and then he eventually kind of became her manager. So in the movie they take a lot of time having them fall in love, much more than 3 days, and then it's like a switch goes off and he just becomes a kind of baddie. And the movie just really focuses very much on, as Ruth says, on this relationship of hers, the housewife, and him as the manager, is getting more and more successful with Tiny Tim and Deep Purple. Crosby, Stills and Nash were bands that he managed, until he finally takes on her and gets serious about it.
Well, here's a clip from I Am Woman. It's an interview, in fact. The reporter here, or the interviewer in this clip, is Erin Sloss, played by Erin Sloss, and Helen Reddy, played by Tilda Cobham Harvey, and the husband, Jeff Wald, played by Evan Peters. And both of them are being interviewed in this case.
What do you think of Alice Cooper dubbing you the Queen of Housewife Rock?
I love it. Alice is just fabulous.
Is it true you don't wear a bra on television?
Would you ask a man if he wears underwear?
We gotta wrap this up.
Now the Equal Rights Amendment is only 8 states short of the required majority to change our Constitution, what do you think of conservative political activist Phyllis Schlafly calling on women to fight against ERA and her claims it will disadvantage housewives and take away the privileges of womanhood?
Well, I disagree. You know, I happen to believe it's high time the Bill of Rights be applied equally to women. I mean, why wouldn't we want a constitution against sex discrimination?
All right, we're good, right?
And Jeff, a few questions for you.
Right.
How does it feel to be Mr. Helen Reddy?
Feels pretty good, actually.
The But to have a wife who's written the unofficial anthem of the women's movement and is the breadwinner in your home, isn't that emasculating?
Well, Jeff and I are a team. We're equals. You know, it's not my career, it's our career. I'm here now because of Jeff. And so he tells me. Jeff hasn't got a modest bone in his body, but that's what makes him sexy.
There we go. Tilda Cobham-Hervey as Helen Reddy, and Evan Peters playing the character of the husband, Jeff Wald, in the midst of that. And the interviewer asking those questions from the period, it has to be said, Erin Sloss. It's extraordinary when you hear that now, Ruth, the kind of the attitudes that were so prevalent and that Helen Reddy and her ilk were fighting against.
Oh, yeah. And the film is full of these little exchanges. And you know, that's really, really interesting. It kind of fills in the background. And you've got to imagine if this reaches a younger audience, they mightn't be familiar with a lot of that kind of very, very, you know, kind of common exchanges that you'd get, and always putting her in her place, and the fact that, you know, her relationship is always with her husband in the first place. So that, you know, that really is very, very interesting. It's just a shame. I mean, even that exchange, I thought, you know, it lacks drama. It's flat. And that's the whole problem with the film, that it just doesn't spring to life. Even though, I mean, I thought Tilda Cobham-Hervey was fantastic in the role. It's not her fault at all.
And I think she's a relative newcomer to the big screen, isn't she?
Oh, she is, yeah. I mean, I don't think I've seen her in, I don't know if you have, Justin, I don't think I've seen her in anything before, but and she's so slight as well, you know, she's almost invisible, she's so slight, and that's, you know, that really helps with the fact that that she's a victim, really, in this, as well as the hero.
And in the midst of all of that, we heard mention of Phyllis Schlafly, who was very memorably played by Cate Blanchett in Miss America, that series that was on recently, and wonderfully so. And the whole politics in and around the Equal Rights Amendment, how was that handled here, Justin?
They do some amazing job with archival footage. Helen Reddy never goes to any of the marches until the very end of the film, but she's watching on TV the marches and the protests. And there's her best friend, Lillian Roxon, who's played by Danielle McDonald. She then is seamlessly interwoven into some of this footage. So it's very much there on TV. You know, it's 9 states that need to ratify, then it's 6, then it's 3. And then, of course, ultimately it fails. So that's always there, but we only see her watching it. We never, like Ruth said, there's no drama for engaging with that, being changed by what she's watching.
Yeah, watching it on television, Ruth. She sounds like the most passive activist as portrayed in this movie. Is that down to the script here? Is that the problem?
I think the script is a big problem. But, you know, the direction's okay, but it could have, you know, it needed a good edit, I think. Just take out some of that background material, sharpen it up, make it faster, and maybe, you know, set some. Those anthems are fantastic. Put them to the foreground. Tell us how, you know, tell us what was going on in her mind when she was doing this. Let's see her composing them, putting them together, and, as Justin says, interacting with the women's group.
Interesting that Unjue Moon, who directs here, she didn't know Helen Reddy beforehand. I mean, that's what would you go off? Is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know.
I think in this case, it's a bad thing.
It shows that she didn't know.
I think it's what Ruth's saying. Like, she kind of stops at the edge of the biographical material and doesn't have that willingness to go into Helen Reddy, or at least how people perceived Helen Reddy at the time, who knew her or were impacted by her. And I think that would have really helped.
All right. You both sound disappointed. How is it? Does it fare up overall? And stars from you, Ruth?
I gave it 2.
And it sounds as if you had a hard job doing even that.
I scraped them together. I mean, I did think that Tilda Cobham-Hervey was good, so 2 for her.
2 for her, mostly. And what are you saying, Justin?
I gave 3 just because I remember Helen Reddy. I remember singing along to I Am Woman on road trips in the 70s with my parents. So I gave it a 3. But it should have been Rocket Man. It should have been a 4.5 or a 5. It's disappointing.
All right. Well, yeah, do you want to relive a little bit of those road trips? Here, let's have a listen.
Because I've heard. And I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything.
I would guess that if you want to hear the feminist philosophies of Helen Reddy, you'll get more in 3 minutes 22 of that song, I Am Woman, than you will in the film that we've just been speaking about, of the same title, 2 and 3 stars respectively, from Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor. Let's move on to film number 2, Summerland, set in the Second World War. An academic named Alice suddenly has to look after a young boy who has been evacuated from London during the Blitz. Gemma Arterton, Ruth, plays the character of Alice. How classic a representation of a female academic would you say this is?
Oh, I groaned. I just died. You know, I died because she's, you know, she's a female academic. So guess what she's studying? Myth and folklore. Guess what she's called? A witch. Guess what she is? She's kind of grumpy and she's on her own because guess what? She's a really sad, neglected academic. I just, you know, I love Gemma Arterton, but I didn't see myself in her.
I fear you may have come to this with a certain set of
preconditions. Yeah, I started off badly on writing.
So just maybe give us a sense. This young boy comes to live with her and inevitably they don't get on at the beginning. I think we know where it's going to go from there.
Oh, yeah. No, it starts, as Ruth said, it starts very predictable. And I was really worried it was going to be really dire. There are a lot of cliches, and especially around Alice's character. But then, yeah, Frank comes. He's a very good young actor, Lucas Bond. And, you know, yeah, they slowly start to get along. You know, he's interested in what she's researching and he's very enthusiastic about it and lets her, of course, talk about the things that she loves. And they kind of start to piece something together that becomes less dire than the opening setups.
All right, well, let's have a listen to the two of them then, the Gemma Arterton as Alice and the young boy Frank, played by Lucas Bond. And they're getting on a little bit better at this point in the film, and they're looking up at the sky as they walk along.
The floating islands in the clouds, is that like heaven?
No, it's physics. Some sort of mirage. Do you believe in heaven?
Yes.
Well, you shouldn't.
Just made up by the Christians.
To make themselves feel better.
How do you know?
Because if it was true, what happened to all the people who died before the Christians? Where did their souls go?
Summerland.
Where?
Summerland. Come on, I know a shortcut.
Where's Summerland?
Here.
In Kent?
No. All around us, like a layer that we can't see until it gets disturbed by a restless soul. It's trying to tell us something.
How?
How do you think? By disturbing the patterns.
Look. Patterns in the clouds. Pagans thought they were signs from Summerland. Magic.
I thought you didn't believe in magic.
I don't.
Stories have to come from somewhere.
There you go. Lucas Bond there playing the character of Frank, Gemma Arterton playing the character of Alice in Summerland Magic. So that aspect, Ruth, is that part, that tale between the young boy and the academic, Alice, is one aspect of the story. But there's a flashback sequence within this part as well, which looks back at a relationship that Alice had with a character called Vera, played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
Yes, that's right. So it flashes back from the 1940s, wartime, to the 1920s, where she has a relationship with another woman. And it's beautifully framed. It's very nostalgically framed. I mean, you can kind of get the tone of the movie even from that, listening to that sequence. That the, you know, it really brings on the orchestral background. It really foregrounds everything and prompts you. So, it's very much that English pastoral. They are two beautiful young women. They have gorgeous picnics. They drive an absolutely delightful car. I was going to say period car, but obviously car of the time.
Yeah.
You know, they're perfectly matched. But, of course, the problem then arises that Vera wants to have children.
Well, let's have a listen to the clip, actually, where we get a sense of what will become a problem in the relationship for them. And at this point, Alice, played by Gemma Arterton, is reading the palm of Vera, played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
And this line?
Ah, oh, that line says you ought to use cold cream.
And this one? You are destined to be a fine novelist, but first you have to finish your book.
What else does my palm say?
That's it.
What about family?
I can't tell.
Why won't you talk about this?
We
need to talk about this. I want a family. What if I want to be a mother?
And there we go. Gugu Mbatha-Raw as Vera, the part of the partnership there that is quite definite that she wants to be a mother, and Alice, played by Gemma Arterton, also within that. You know, when I hear it in isolation, Ruth, I'm suddenly aware of that very syrupy music underneath it. But I have to admit, maybe I was just feeling soft, but I found particularly that relationship and how it was portrayed very, very touching.
Well, good for you, Sean.
You didn't.
No, I was. There's a sequence in the shop where she's where she buys a bar of chocolate and doesn't give it to the child who thinks she's going to. I'm the child in this one, but I mean, I think, you know, there are some. If you're in the mood for a British period movie, this has got British period movie written all over it. It very much belongs to that ilk. I mean, and I'm a big fan of Gemma Arterton. Though, if you're going to watch a wartime British period movie with Gemma Arterton, I would recommend Their Finest, another female-centred film, which I thought was a lot better. But, I mean, it brings you into the moment. It is very beautiful. It does have that kind of slightly mystical thing because, you know, as we played, Summerland is this sort of dream space. Yeah.
The other, I suppose, is important to mention here, Penelope Wilton plays the older Alice, which kind of that story bookends the film itself. I'm not sure how necessary that was, but there was another character that I think you wanted to mention, the Tom Courtney character.
Oh, well, I saw
you didn't see half enough of him, Justin.
No, when I saw Tom Courtney was in it, I was very excited. He plays the school principal, and he basically only has two scenes where he says more than good morning, students. Mm. And I didn't even know if that was allowed, that you could use Tom Courtney so little, but he does have one really good scene with Gemma Arterton, and I guess that's why he was there. But yeah, the film is very much about Vera and Alice, and then Vera and Alice and Frank, and this loss that's in Alice's life.
There's a huge plot coincidence that I think is a big problem for all of us, Ruth.
Oh yeah, it is. I mean, it's suddenly, I suppose you should have seen it coming, but it was so obvious you think it couldn't, you know.
Yeah,
but it has a really clunky plot contrivance. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So I may have been a little upset earlier in the day today. You weren't, Ruth. How many stars are you giving?
No, well, I was actually more generous than you might expect. So I gave it a whopping 3 out of 5.
And is that for the look of it and the sound of it?
I think it did what it set out to do.
Yeah.
It made you a promise. It delivered on it.
Justin, a little more conflicted, I think.
Well, I just thought it was very inconsistent. I thought it had some three moments very much at the beginning, or even two moments. And then I really thought the third act kind of saved it despite this awful
clunk
coincidence, this clunk
in
the middle that they try to sort of then bail out of. But I went for 4 stars and I thought the same thing. It is what I thought it would be. It was a British, you know, period film that would make me feel good.
Yeah,
I did. So
I had a bit of Kleenex around the house at the time as well. There you go. Let us move on to our final film then. This is Henry Glassy Fieldwork, a documentary by Pat Collins here. Who are we talking about, Ruth, when we talk about Henry Glassy?
Well, Henry Glassy is a very celebrated folklorist, American folklorist, who has written a massive amount of books on folklore, and he also spends a lot of his time traveling from place to place, studying groups of people, you know, doing singing, making craft work in their own environment, doing what they do. And in fact, he's got an Irish connection because he spent quite a lot of years in Ballymenone in County Fermanagh, which is in fact where the film ends up, studying the traditions of the people there.
Let's listen to the voice of Henry Glassy. This is the very beginning of the movie, in fact, in voiceover, we get a sense of what he feels about creativity, folklore and art.
We're born alone, we die alone, we are each one of us individuals. We're born, we live, we die among others. We are all of us members of society. That inescapable complexity, the unity in being of the personal and the social, is at its peak made sensate in creative acts that allow us to be ourselves, to communicate, to connect with others, and build within the social alliances of mutual benefit. Call it art, call it folklore, but that's what it is, a momentary fulfillment of what it is to be human.
The voice of Henry Glassie from Pat Collins' documentary Henry Glassie Fieldwork. Justin, what this film does in many ways, it takes us to the places that Henry Glassie went to, Brazil, Turkey, Bangladesh, and as Ruth mentioned, Ireland. And we literally sit and watch people making pieces of art in front of our eyes over slow periods of time.
No, it's remarkable. I wish I'd known beforehand because I got a little impatient and then when I got into it, I relaxed. Mm. But yeah, after that speech that he gives at the beginning, the next 33 minutes is watching a couple of artists in Brazil, one of them doing a clay sculpture, a religious sculpture, and somebody making then a sculpture out of found metal. And we're just sitting there watching it
happen.
And it feels like real time. It's not quite, but and when they speak, there's no subtitles. So you don't know exactly what's being said. And then, of course, at about 45 minutes, finally the interview with Henry Glassie starts.
Yeah.
And we realize we've been put in his shoes. This is what he does. He goes places. He was in Ireland 11 years. He goes places. He doesn't know the language. And he's that outsider.
But he quotes Ruth Lady Gregory at one point about the practice of field work, reverence and patience. And that is what he displays. And indeed, Pat Collins displays, I think, in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Pat Collins' work, and I think that this he's an incredibly busy documentary filmmaker, Pat Collins, for somebody who makes very, very niche work, as this is. And I would put this in the same bracket as his film, his documentary, Connemara, which featured a foreground of the late Tim Robinson. And I think what Collins does is he picks subjects for his films, and these people in turn become a kind of collage of voices that if you put all his films together, you'd get a kind of, not a single voice coming out, but a set of thoughts that are very complementary to each other.
And just briefly, Justin, the story, the Irish storytellers that we get at the end of it, did they tickle your fancy?
Oh, no, they were fantastic. I mean, he makes a really interesting point, Henry Glassie. He said, you know, because the two brothers, the Nolan brothers, are quite poor. And he said, you know, if circumstances had been different, like Hugh Nolan could have been a professor at Oxford. Like, that's how rich and deep his knowledge was. And it was great, you know, and how he immersed himself in that community and how they felt about him was really interesting.
Stars from you then, Justin.
Yeah, I just thought it was a fascinating journey in his shoes of his research and really his obsession. I mean, he's retired and 12 years later, here he is still doing it. So I thought an easy four.
An easy four from you. And what are you saying, Ruth, overall?
Yeah, I'm joining Justin in four. And I just would like to say, with the usual footnote, this is what I'm kind of wheeled on to do. It would have been five, but I'm still waiting for Collins to make a documentary that foregrounds a female character.
All right. So that's the docking of the star is Pat Collins rather than the film, possibly.
Okay. That's for the Irv.
Right. So that's Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor there speaking to us about Summerland and I Am Woman, which are released digitally this weekend. Henry Glassie Fieldwork will have screenings in independent cinemas around the country in the autumn, subject, of course, to our whole situation regarding COVID and restrictions therein. Author of About a Boy and High Anxiety, Nick Hornby, is talking to us next about his latest novel. 29 minutes past seven on Thursday night, Serena. Nick Hornby is the best-selling author of novels such as High Fidelity, not the book I mentioned before the break, High Fidelity and About a Boy, along with several works of non-fiction, including his groundbreaking debut, Fever Pitch. He has written numerous award-winning screenplays for film and television, including Brooklyn, Wild and State of the Union. Just Like You is his ninth novel. It tells the story of Joseph, a 22-year-old working-class black man, and Lucy, a 42-year-old white middle-class teacher who fall in love against the backdrop of North London on the brink of the Brexit referendum. And delighted to have Nick Hornby join me on the line now. You couldn't have put more obstacles between your two characters here, really, Nick, could you? Joseph, the 22-year-old working-class black man, Lucy, plus 20 years, a 42-year-old white middle-class teacher. Chalk and cheese, really.
Well, as it turns out, I think the book demonstrates that they're not, but the obstacles that were in their path looked as though they'd be enough to deter them or anyone else, actually.
Was there one or other of those obstacles that, you know, even at the starting point, you thought was going to be the one that would be the biggest problem for them to overcome?
No, I didn't think so. But as I wrote the book, I could see that age is actually the hardest one to think about and to address if you're in a relationship. There's 20 years between them. And age is so defining in so many ways. So they kind of have to come to an agreement to stop time temporarily and see where that takes them.
Yeah, in particular, that isn't helped by the fact that that Joseph has a penchant, even though he works in a butcher shop, he has a penchant for DJing. And the music that he might be DJing to or making as a DJ, Lucy is a long way away from that music.
Yeah, there's a rather crushing moment for her when she tries to express enthusiasm for something that he's made by dancing a bit. And clearly it's the most excruciating thing I've ever seen, and he has to interrupt and stop it.
Yeah, I didn't know that a 42-year-old white middle-class woman could do dad dancing, but it kind of sounds as if that's kind of what she was doing.
Well, it wasn't his sort of dancing anyway, so
that's
that was enough.
That's for absolute sure. So when you started out then, Nick, were you still thinking, were you working towards a romance, really, and simply how did these two people overcome their difficulties, or in fact find out that the difficulties aren't as big as they think they are? Was it just a romantic story that you were exploring, or when did the politics start to click in?
Well, I had the idea of the couple some time ago. I'd observed a couple in a shop having a little flirt, and I just, as I was watching, thinking, oh, they'll never get together. This was a customer and someone behind the counter, even though they were quite cute. And I could see why they wouldn't get together, because there were differences between them. And as I came away, I thought, actually, I wonder if those differences are as important or as profound as we really think. And I kept thinking about it every few months, every year or so. And it wasn't until the referendum and the aftermath that I thought, oh, actually, maybe now is the time to write about what separates us.
Yeah, because what's very interesting, I mean, you said to me at the very top of this that, in fact, you know, they aren't chalk and cheese, despite the fact that they seem to have so many differences between them. They are eminently suited to each other. What was happening in Britain, particularly around the time of the referendum debates, it was all about how different we all are, or certainly, yeah, I suppose, how different those who want to stay are from how different those who want to leave are, or where.
Yeah. And I started to get irritated with my own team, actually. I voted Remain, and I didn't talk to that many people before the referendum who were voting to leave. But afterwards, I started to observe really how far out of our comfort zone we'd all been taken, and we were having passionate arguments about things we knew nothing about. I mean, I know my friends know everything about movies and books and Arsenal and so on, but they were shouting at each other about World Trade Organization terms. And I thought, how has this happened that we're pretending this knowledge?
So, and it was irritating to you, even though you were on the same side as many of these arguments.
Well, a lot of the time it ended up being insulting to the other side. And I thought, actually, this really isn't good enough, because it's half the country. And you can't call half the country misguided or stooges or dim. There's something more than that going on. So when I was writing the book, I wanted to adopt a neutral position. And in fact, Joseph in the book ends up spoiling his ballot paper and voting for both sides, because he's torn between some of the people he knows from home and Lucy, who's an ardent European.
Mm. And what about then, you know, the issue of, as you were quite definitely a Remainer or a voter for Remain, how difficult was it for you to, because you do go into trying to find characters and exploring characters then who would have been leavers, who would have voted leave. Was that a difficult aspect of the writing?
No, I kind of relished it, because I wanted to think about it more, and I wanted to listen to people. You know, I was online a lot and reading things and thinking, how have they arrived at the position they're at? And it felt quite refreshing, actually, to present the other side sometimes.
And did you wonder, did the writing of the novel perhaps bring you to a greater understanding of the other side of the argument?
Yes, completely. And I don't know how many people would change their minds if they could see the mess that has been made and is about to be made. But at the time, I can see what was going on.
You said you were irritated by those who were on the same side as you. Were you less irritated by those who weren't on the same side, or were you more irritated?
In my book, I was less irritated because I made characters that I like. I got fed up with watching people on Question Time and the like just chuntering on about out means out. I mean, that was the other thing, is that words lost all their meaning. And no argument took you anywhere. But the day after the referendum, I was sent, as were a lot of people, a petition. And the petition was to either overturn the vote or to have another vote. And I, at the time, I thought, this is crazy, you know. 17 million or 18 million people have just voted to leave, and 500,000 people are saying you've got to ignore the result. And it was so profoundly undemocratic that I began to be a bit troubled by it.
So your democratic bones kicked in immediately, saying, yeah, I voted my way, more people voted the other way, so let's just get on with it.
Yeah, and let's see who's right, actually, in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can probably guess who you think will win that particular debate. So obviously, you know, get two sides of the argument in a work of fiction. You give us there the pro-Brexit and the anti-Brexit, if you like. Your two leading characters here, Lucy and Joseph, I suppose both of them, you had to make quite big leaps of the imagination. You know, you have to put yourself into the shoes of a 22-year-old young black working class man, and into the mind of a 42-year-old middle class North London based teacher. Was either or one of those more difficult than the other?
No, I mean, I think the moment you start writing about people who are not yourself, which I did, you know, not in my career, but at a certain point, then everything has to be imagined, and you have to feel around to see if it seems true to you. With Joseph, I was more nervous because of, you know, the way the world is at the moment, and I didn't know if I had the right to do it, but I eventually decided that I have to write about everyone in my community, not just people who are the same colour as me.
And how did you? I mean, you had reservations. What kind of reservations did you have, and how did you face those down? As you probably had to do in some ways within yourself. I mean, face them down.
Well, the thing about being a writer is you can be an idiot up until a certain point because it's just you and the computer. I remember feeling that when I wrote Fever Pitch. You know, I was writing a memoir about me and my family, and I thought, oh, this is fine, you know. And then you see it in a bookshop, you think, oh, my God, what have I done? So to a certain extent, I was just trotting along quite happily and creating a character, you know, drawn from people I knew and things I'd seen. But when I'd finished, then I showed it to people of colour and said, right, you can beat me up about it now. Mm. You know, there were a couple of suggestions which I acted upon, but mostly I just had to trust myself. And if the book fails, then it fails artistically, not because I think I did the wrong thing morally.
How different is it, you know, and what is the type of responsibility that you feel in a different way when you're taking somebody else's work, as you did indeed with our own Cullum Tobin's Brooklyn and adapted that for the screen, or with An Education, which you also adapted for the screen? Talk to me a little bit about the adaptation of Brooklyn. Is it easier to take somebody else's book and, if you like, not tear it apart, but reinvent it for a different medium than it would be to do it with your own?
The problem with doing my own, which I don't do, is I've spent 2 years writing the book, and every movie I've been involved in takes about 5 years to make. So that's 7 years of thinking about the same material, which I really don't want to do. I want to do something fresh. And with Brooklyn and Education and Wild, what I was given was the opportunity to get out of my own head and into somebody else's head, and it feels so refreshing. To have material that I couldn't have generated myself. And, you know, Colm's a great writer, but he was so unbelievably supportive that I never really felt that nervous, because he did nothing but encourage us.
Yeah, I suppose being a novelist himself, he possibly understood the dilemma in which you find yourself, you know, the things that you have to face and just moving from one medium to the other.
Yeah, and that things are going to have to get cut, and some things are going to have to be made more explicit. And he was very intuitive about being adapted. And I think that he loved the result. Mm. Well, he turned up to enough screenings, so I think he must have loved the result. He must have seen it like 50 times.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to me a little bit about State of the Union, which I'm guessing this was a COVID-related project, in that it was a 10 minute episodes featuring Chris O'Dowd and Rosamund Pike as a couple with a marriage.
I actually predicted COVID by writing State of the Union. Now, it was entirely kind of whimsical. I was doing a lot of film work at the time, and sometimes you have to wait 3 or 4 weeks for people to read and get back to you, and while they're trying to cast or get money or whatever. And I thought I'd like to not start something long. I'd like to have a go at something short and see where it takes me. And I'd had this idea before and not knowing what to do with it. So I thought I'd just try writing 10-minute episodes and see what happens.
Well, I heard Chris O'Dowd speaking about it, and he talked about, you know, the kind of the density of the dialogue in the 10-minute episode. Were you aware of that, you know, that things were, I suppose, more distilled when it comes to writing a short piece like that?
Well, I mean, you can see it on the page when you're writing it, you know, that each of them had 50% of the script, basically, and they're doing nothing but sitting at a pub table and occasionally crossing the road. Mm. So they're talking all the time, and it was very intense work for the actors. I mean, it was like a 3-week shoot, but I think they had more words in those 100 minutes than they would have had in anything else they'd ever done.
There you go. So what happens next, Nick? Where are you heading? Novels, another short work or adaptation, or do you know what is next on the desk?
Well, I'm working on something that's it's a big TV series. I don't know if it will happen or not, because you never know whether these things will happen. And it's music related, and it's real people.
Oh, well, now I'm tickled. Can you tell me any more? Give me where are the real people from? What city?
Where are the real people from? They're from England, in England.
A city.
Ah.
I think you may have answered it by not answering, perhaps. Okay, well, look, I don't know. We'll see in time. Nick, lovely to speak with you this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a million. That's Nick Hornby speaking to us about his latest novel, Just Like You, which is published by Viking, an imprint of Penguin Books. Let's travel back to the 1980s. Peter Murphy, you are here to talk about Sweet Dreams, the story of the New Romantics, a book by Dylan Jones. But
Your chosen subject tonight is the music of the 1980s. While I fix my eyeliner, can you identify the tracks that we just heard? How many of them?
My life is flashing before me. Four. Okay. Oh, yeah. Notorious by Duran Duran.
Correct.
Late Duran Duran. Love Action by the Human League.
Yeah.
Temptation by Heaven 17.
Yeah.
And Tainted Love by Soft Cell.
Oh, wow. Four out of four. No passes.
It's ingrained in the very lines in my palms.
Yeah, so we're talking about this book, Sweet Dreams. And I suppose, yep. You know, we're going to think of bands like Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, New Romantics. We're often written off, though, for being more concerned with the frill on their shirt or indeed their eyeliner than their musical output. But Dylan Jones, editor-in-chief of GQ magazine, he wants to set the record straight in this book.
Yeah, I mean, the bands involved would agree very much about the importance of the haircut and the eyeliner and the cut of their jib. Dylan Jones has form in this regard. He did an amazing oral history of David Bowie a couple of years ago, and he's a very prolific author. He was there. He was there at the beginning of the Blitz Club. He was there for the post-punk. He was there throughout documenting this entire scene in what was known as the style press, something that didn't exist until the early 80s, which would have been magazines like The Face, Blitz, ID, and later on became Arena and GQ. The genius of the scene is a phrase of Brian Eno's. It's about the importance of the people who go to the gigs or go to the clubs or take the photographs or design the clothes or dress the stars or set up the record labels and the record shops as much as the people at the centre of it. There's 153 people interviewed in this book. Mm. And it's really
a big tome, 600 pages or so, isn't it?
Yeah. It's quite extraordinary that this era hasn't been documented as deeply as this before, because this is a really important social document, as well as being an absolute hoot and a howl. I mean, some of the stories in here. There's a story of Duran Duran going on tour with David Bowie in Australia in 1983. And by all accounts, they made Motley Crue look like the monkeys.
Duran Duran, does that give me a reason to play this? It does. There we go. Girls on Film from Duran Duran. And actually, as that was playing, Peter Murphy, you were saying to me, what was that? What was the John Carney film? And it was Sing Street, which was set in this era.
There was a great line in Sing Street where the older brother is saying, you know, well, John Taylor's a really good bass player, man. And it's like, just listening to that, you know, they were good musicians. Mm. They were steeped in stuff like Chic and Giorgio Moroder and all that sort of New York dance floor stuff.
But Girls on Film, even the song, the theme of the song itself brings us to that Brian Eno phrase that you just gave us, the genius of the scene, because this videos were the big thing, I suppose, at the time as well. And Duran Duran, more than many, were extravagant in their video making.
Well, there's a period that Dylan Jones outlines, which is where you had Boy George on the cover of Rolling Stone, and the headline was something like Britain invades the USA again. It was the first time in 20 years that the charts were dominated. Now, a huge part of that was MTV. And the beginning of an era where, you know, record labels started to spend more on videos than they did on the entire album budget. And so you had an entire generation of bands like Visage. Steve Strange was the frontman of Visage. Rusty Egan and Midge were the main sort of musical players. Midge who'd done everything from Thin Lizzy, guested with Thin Lizzy, and went on to, of course, join Ultravox. Steve Strange was the doorman on the Blitz Club. The Blitz Club was a Covent Garden Tuesday night club that was kind of sealed off. It was a safe space for people to experiment with the look, with the androgynous look. It was a really important place in terms of people being openly gay and not fearing getting beaten up. So that's where an awful lot of these bands stemmed from. Spandau Ballet were almost like the house band. there. Steve Strange was the doorman, the proprietor. He basically picked the kinds of people that should be allowed into the club, as well as being an extraordinary looking gent himself. But, you know, there was some controversy as to the kinds of people who got turned away on occasion.
You talked there about the extravagance of things in those videos. And this was part of, politically, they were often castigated or criticised for very Tory attitudes.
There was a real split in terms of the media. So you had the old school, like the Enemy and Sounds.
And how does Dylan Jones handle that debate?
It's quite an extraordinary situation in that most of the musicians, most of the acts involved were left-wing socialists. Mm. Apart from, I think, Tony Hadley, who was the only one in Spandau Ballet who was a Tory, and Gary Newman, infamously, was a Tory voter. But pretty much everybody else was pro-miners' strike, anti-Falklands War, politically engaged, if not explicitly in the songs, then in their interviews. Where the confusion came about was that they were so obviously flagrantly aspirational, you know. Yeah. And it was such an un-British movement because they were so much more American in its attitude. Mm. There's a scene in the book where one of Dylan Jones's friends, Fiona Dealey, who was one of the great scenesters at the time, is in the audience at a Roxy Music gig, and she's looking up at the VIP box and all these photographers like Anthony Price and these high society people, and she goes, I want to be there. Whereas perhaps in previous generations it would be, I want to tear that box down.
Yeah, punk certainly wouldn't want it to have been up there. That's, there's no doubt about that. You talked about aspirational, you talked about Gary Newman. I suppose you don't get much more aspirational than, what kind of car do you want to drive? Ah, yeah, it's such a journey down nostalgia road, isn't it? When you listen to tracks like that, Gary Newman and Cars. But you were saying, as we were listening to that, Peter Murphy, you were talking about the importance of sci-fi, the importance of Kraftwerk, and this whole synth pop idea that was a pop single.
It's amazing that that period was so futuristic and forward-looking. Mm. And it came out of a sort of a post-war era. So a huge influence on a lot of these bands would have been Kraftwerk and the other German bands like Can and Neu and Faust. Very futuristic industrial culture. And like the filmmakers at the time as well, Fassbinder and Wim Wenders and Herzog, they were all trying to build a new society and forget about World War II. Whereas the British kids were literally crawling out of potholes that hadn't been filled in since the Blitz. And in New York, you had a recession with, you know, rubbish bags left on the street, as there was in London with the strikes that were going on. And in Harlem and the Bronx, you had young black kids adopting really futuristic styles like wedge cuts and inventing hip hop and basically the seeds of Afrofuturism. So that came out of a really grim, grey time in which there was no money and it was constantly
But you make you make interesting connections. And does Jones do this in the book, you know, the importance of people like Stanley Kubrick, William Burroughs and J.G. Ballard to bands like Joy Division?
It's there. Yeah, he covers pretty much, he begins with the roots of this stuff, which is Bowie, of course, Roxy Music and Kraftwerk. They're like the Holy Trinity. And they all, while sometimes they're kind of a little bit postmodern and knowing and retro, they, even Brian Ferry, when he was, you know, crooning in his tux, he looked like, you know, it was in a space age club. And Andy McKay, the sax player, had a quiff that was 7 feet high and sprayed silver, and was, you know, and they all looked really alien. They looked freakish. And then you'd stuff like Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer's I Feel Love, which sounded like, you know, the most erotic space age track you've ever heard. And a lot of this was because you had the original analog synthesizers, which looked like a switchboard, a telephonist thing. You had the microchip, which made synthesizers affordable. And idiots like us could play them with one finger.
He does meet up, Jones, obviously, you said that it's an oral history. That's his style of writing here. He does meet up with a lot of these ex-pop stars. Are there those who are just, you know, washed up and finished?
The story of Steve Strange himself is quite tragic, really. From as early as 1985, there's, you know, reports of him, you know, forever out in the clubs and talking about a new scheme that he had going. He died quite recently, but he really did kind of fade from the scene because he was a scenester. He was less a musician and more a kind of a curator, an incredibly important figure. But very much once that tide passed, he was kind of, he was beached. Mm. And what happened was after 1985, you had outliers like Adam and the Ants, who were amazing as well. They weren't really new romantics, but they were using visuals. But Frankie Goes to Hollywood and The Tube. And after Live Aid, everybody started to get a bit more kind of, they either turned into stadium bands like Duran Duran or Simple Minds, or they became more concerned about being, you know, real bands like Eurythmics went from synth pop to being a proper band.
Eurythmics are the last band you mentioned. That's the last band we'd hear because they'd give us the title of the book. Are you recommending this, The Story of the New Romantics from Dylan Jones?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful book.
It's a wonderful book. It's also a wonderful track. Sometimes there's just not enough time. Sweet Dreams are made of this from the Eurythmics, finishing up that item on a book also called Sweet Dreams, The Story of the New Romantics, Dylan Jones, published by Faber and Faber. And it was Peter Murphy who was reviewing for us this evening. That's our lot for tonight. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gard Duffy, who was on sound this evening. You see, people have masks on, it's hard to see. Gard Duffy was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.